lot of guts at that young age, which didn't, however, get her out of Phil's grip. I remember watching Ronnie do a vocal at Gold Star Studios. "Shut up, Phil, I know how it should go." Ronnie remembered how we were on that tour together. Ronnie Spector. Keith and I made ways to be together. I remember on that tour in England, there was so much fog that the bus had to actually stop. And Keith and I got out, and we went over to this little cottage, and this old lady came to the door, sort of heavy and so sweet. And I said, "Hi, I'm Ronnie of the Ronettes." And Keith said, "I'm Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, and we can't move our bus because we can't see any farther than our hands." So she says, "Oh, come on in, kids, I'll give you something." And she gave us scones, tea, then she gave us extra ones to bring back to the bus, and to be honest, those were the happiest days of my entire career. We were 20 years old, and we just fell in love. What do you do when you hear a record like Be My Baby, and suddenly you are? But same old story. Can't let anybody else know. So it was a terrible thing in a way. But basically, it was just hormones. And sympathy. Without us even thinking about it, we both realized that we were awash in this sea of sudden success, and that other people were directing us, and we didn't like it. But nothing much you can do about it. Not on the road. But then, we would never have met if we had not been in this weird situation. Ronnie only wanted the best for people, and never quite got the best for herself. But her heart was definitely in the right place. I went to the Strand Palace Hotel and looked her up early one morning. "Just want to say hello." The tour was about to leave for Manchester or somewhere. We had to all get on the bus. So I just figured I'd pick her up before. Nothing happened then. I just helped her to pack. But it was a very bold move for me because I'd never put the come on to any chick. We were reunited in New York not long after this, as I will tell. And I've always kept in touch with Ronnie. On the day of 9/11, we were recording together a song called Love Affair in New York. It is a work in progress. In the arrogance of youth, the idea of being a rock star or a pop star was taking a step down from being a blues man and playing the clubs. For us to have to dip our feet into commercialism in 1962 or 63 was for a small while distasteful. The Rolling Stones, when they started, the limits of their ambition was just to be the best fucking band in London. We disdained the provinces. It was a real London mindset. But once the world beckoned, it didn't take long for the scales to fall from the eyes. Suddenly the whole world was opening up. The Beatles were proving that. It's not that easy being famous. You don't want to be. But at the same time, you've got to be in order to do what you're doing. And you realize you've already made the deal at the crossroads. Nobody said this was the deal. But within a few weeks, months, you realize that you've made the deal, and that you are now set on a path that is not your aesthetically ideal path. Stupid teenage idealisms, purisms, bullshit. You're now set on the path, along with all those people that you wanted to follow anyway, like Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson. You've already made the fucking deal. And now, you have to follow it. Just like all your brothers and sisters and ancestors, you are now on the road.
Chapter 5. The Stones' first tour of the USA. Meeting Bobby Keys at the San Antonio State Fair. Chess Records, Chicago. I hook up with the future Ronnie Spector and go to the Apollo in Harlem. Fleet Street and Andrew Oldham provide our new popular image. Long-haired, obnoxious, and dirty. Mick and I write a song we can give the Stones. We go to L.A. and record with Jack Nietzsche at RCA. I write Satisfaction in my sleep, and we have our first number one. Alan Klein becomes our manager. Linda Keith breaks my heart. I buy my country house, Redlands. Brian begins to melt down and meets Anita Pallenberg. The first time the Stones went to America, we felt we'd died and gone to heaven. It was the summer of 64. Everybody had their own little thing about America. Charlie would go down to the Metropole when it was still swinging and see Eddie Condon. First thing I did was visit Colony Records and buy every Lenny Bruce album I could find. Yeah, I was amazed by how old-fashioned and European New York seemed. Quite different to what I'd imagined. Bellboys, maitre d's, all that sort of thing. Unnecessary fluff and very unexpected. It was as if somebody had said, these are the rules of 1920, and it hadn't changed a bit since. And on the other hand, it was the fastest moving modern place you could be. And the radio, you couldn't believe it after England. Being there at a time of a real musical explosion, sitting in a car with the radio on was beyond heaven. You could turn the channels and get 10 country stations, 5 black stations, and if you were traveling the country and they faded out, you just turn the dial again, and there was another great song. Black music was exploding. It was a powerhouse. In Motown, they had a factory, but without turning out automatons. We lived off Motown on the road, just waiting for the next 4 tops or the next Temptations. Motown was our food, on the road and off. Listening to car radios through 1,000 miles to get to the next gig. That was the beauty of America. We used to dream of it before we got there. I knew Lenny Bruce might not be every American's sense of humor, but I thought from there I could get a thread to the secrets of the culture. He was my entree into American satire. Lenny was the man. The sick humor of Lenny Bruce. I'd taken him in long before I got to America. So I was well prepared when on the Ed Sullivan Show, Mick wasn't allowed to sing, Let's Spend the Night Together. We had to sing, Let's Spend Some Time Together. Talk about shades and nuances. What does that mean? Especially to CBS. A night is not allowed? Unbelievable. It used to make us laugh. It's pure Lenny Bruce. Titty is a dirty word? What's dirty? The word or the titty? Andrew and I walked into the Brill Building, the Tin Pan Alley of U.S. Song, to try and see the great Jerry Lieber. But Jerry Lieber wouldn't see us. Someone recognized us and took us in and played us all these songs. And we walked out with Down Home Girl by Lieber and Butler, a great funk song that we recorded in November 1964. Looking for the Decca offices in New York on one of our ventures, we ended up in a motel on 26th and 10th, with a drunken Irishman called Walt McGuire, a crew-cut guy who looked as if he'd just gone out of the American Navy. This was the head of the U.S. Decca office. And we suddenly realized the great Decca Record Company was actually some warehouse in New York. It was a car trick. Oh, yes, we have big offices in New York. And it was down on the docks on the West Side Highway. We were listening to chick songs, doo-wop, Uptown Soul, the Marvelettes, the Crystals, the Chiffons, the Chantels, all of this stuff coming in our ears, and we're loving it. And the Ronettes, the hottest girl group around. Will You Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. Shirley Owens, their lead singer, had an almost untrained voice, beautifully balanced with a fragility and simplicity, almost as if she wasn't a singer. All this stuff you heard, no doubt the Beatles had an effect. Please, Mr. Postman, and Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers. If we tried to play anything like that down at the Richmond Station Hotel, it would have been, what? I've gone mad. because they wanted to hear hard-duty Chicago blues that no other band could play as well as we could. The Beatles certainly could never have played it like that. At Richmond, it was our workmanlike duty not to stray from the path. The first show we ever did in America was at the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, California. Bobby Goldsboro, who taught me the Jimmy Reed lick, he was on the show and the Chiffons. But earlier, we'd had the experience of Dean Martin introducing us at the taping of the Hollywood Palace TV show. In America, then, if you had long hair, you were a faggot as well as a freak. They would shout across the street, "Hey, fairies!" Dean Martin introduced us as something like, "These long-haired wonders from England are Rolling Stones. They're backstage picking the fleas off each other." A lot of sarcasm and eyeball rolling. Then he said, "Don't leave me alone with this," gesturing with horror in our direction. This was Dino, the rebel rat packer who cocked his finger at the entertainment world by pretending to be drunk all the time. We were, in fact, quite stunned. English compares and showbiz types may have been hostile, but they didn't treat you like some dumb circus act. Before we'd gone on, he'd had the bouffanted King Sisters and performing elephants standing on their hind legs. I love old Dino. He was a pretty funny bloke, even though he wasn't ready for the changing of the guard. On to Texas and more freak show appearances. In one case, with a pool of performing seals between us and the audience at the San Antonio, Texas State Fair. That was where I first met Bobby Keys, the great saxophone player, my closest pal. We were born within hours of each other. A soul of rock and roll, a solid man, also a depraved maniac. The other guy in that gig was George Jones. They trailed in with a tumbleweed following them, as if tumbleweed was their pet. Dust all over the place, bunch of cowboys. But when George got up, we went, "Whoa, there's a master up there." You have to ask Bobby Keys how big Texas is. It took me 30 years to convince him that Texas was actually just a huge land grab by Sam Houston and Stephen Austin. "No fucking way. How dare you?" He's red in the face. So I laid a few books on him about what actually happened between Texas and Mexico. And 6 months later, he says, "Your case seems to have some substance." "I know the feeling, Bob. I used to believe that Scotland Yard was lily white." But Bobby Keys should be allowed to tell the tale of our first meeting, since this is a Texan story. He flatters me, but in this case, I have allowed it. I first met Keith Richards physically in San Antonio, Texas. I was so biased against that man before I actually met him. They recorded a song, "Not Fade Away," by a guy named Buddy Holly, born in Lubbock, Texas, same as me. I said, "Hey, that was Buddy's song. Who are these pasty-faced, funny-talking, skinny-legged guys to come over here and cash in on Buddy's song? I'll kick their asses." I didn't care much for the Beatles. I kind of secretly liked them. But I saw the death of the saxophone unraveling before my eyes. "None of these guys have saxes in their bands, man. I'm going to be playing Tijuana brass shit for the rest of my life." I didn't think, "Great, we're going to be on the same show." I was playing with a guy named Bobby V, who had a hit at the time called "Rubber Ball." "I keep bouncing back to you." And we were headlining the show until they came on. And then they were headlining the show. And this was Texas, man. This was my stomping ground. We were all staying at the same hotel in San Antonio, and they were out on the balcony, Brian and Keith and I think Mick. I went out and listened to them, and there was some actual rock and roll going on there, in my humble opinion. And of course I knew all about it, given it was invented in Texas and me being present at its birth. And the band was really, really good. and they did not fade away actually better than Buddy ever did it. Now, I never said that to them or anybody else. I thought maybe I'd judge these guys too harshly. So the next day, we must have played 3 shows with them, and about the 3rd time I was in the dressing room with them, they were all talking about the American acts, how before they went on stage they all changed clothes, which we did. We went on with our black mohair suits and white shirts and ties, which was stupid, because it's 900 degrees outside, summertime in San Antonio. And they were saying, "Why don't we ever change clothes?" And they said, "Yeah, that's a good idea." I'm expecting them to whip out some suits and ties, but they just changed clothes with each other. I thought that was great. You gotta realize that the vision, the image, according to 1964 U.S. rock and roll standards, was mohair suit and tie and nicey-nicey old boy next door. And all of a sudden, here comes his truckload of English jackflies, interlopers, singing a Buddy Holly song. Damn! I couldn't really hear all that well, amplifiers and PAs being what they were, but man, I felt it. I just fucking felt it, and it made me smile and dance. They didn't dress alike, they didn't do sets, they just broke all the fucking rules and made it work. And that is what enchanted the shit out of me. So, being inspired by this, the next day, I got my mohair suit out and put the trousers on, and my toenail split the seam down the front, and I didn't have anything else to wear. So I wore my shirt and tie and put on Bermuda shorts and cowboy boots. I didn't get fired. I got, "What are you? How dare? What is fucking going on, man?" It redefined a lot of stuff for me. The American music scene, the whole set of teenage idols and clean-cut boys from next door and nice little songs, all that went right out the fucking window when these guys showed up. Along with the press. "Would you let your daughter?" All that stuff. Forbidden fruit. Anyway, somehow they noticed what I did, and I noticed what they did. And we just kind of met there. Really just brushed paths. And then I ran into them again in L.A. when they were doing the TAMI show. I discovered that Keith and I had the same birthday, both born 12/18/43. He told me, "Bubby, you know what that means. We're half man and half horse, and we got a license to shit in the streets." Well, that's just one of the greatest pieces of information I have received in my life. The whole heart and soul of this band is Keith and Charlie. I mean, that's apparent to anybody who's breathing or has a musical bone in his body. That is where the engine room is. I'm not a school musician. I can't read music. I never had any professional training. But I can feel stuff. And when I heard him playing guitar, it reminded me so much of the energy I heard from Buddy and I heard from Elvis. There was something there that was the real deal. Even though he was playing Chuck Berry, it was still the real deal, you know? And I'd heard some pretty good guitar players coming out of Lubbock. Orbison came from Vernon, a few hours away. I used to listen to him and Buddy at the skating rink. And Scotty Moore and Elvis Presley would come through town. So I'd heard some pretty good guitar players. And there was just something about Keith that immediately reminded me of Holly. They're about the same size. Buddy was a skinny guy, had bad teeth. Keith was a mess. But some folks, they just got a look in their eye, and he looked dangerous, and that's the truth. There was a stark thing he discovered about America. It was civilized around the edges, but 50 miles inland from any major American city, whether it was New York, Chicago, L.A., or Washington, you really did go into another world. In Nebraska and places like that, we got used to them saying, "Hello, girls." We just ignored it. At the same time, they felt threatened by us because their wives were looking at us and going, "That's interesting." Not what they were used to every bloody day, not some beer-swilling redneck. Everything they said was offensive, but the actual drive behind it was very much defense. We just wanted to go in, have a pancake or a cup of coffee with some ham and eggs. But we had to be prepared to put up with some taunting. All we were doing was playing music. But what we realized was we were going through some very interesting social dilemmas and clashes, and whole loads of insecurities, it seemed to me. Americans were supposed to be brash and self-confident. Bullshit. That's just a front. Especially the men. Especially in those days. They didn't know quite what was happening. Things did happen fast. I'm not surprised that a few guys just couldn't get the spin on it. The only hostility I can recall on a consistent basis was from white people. Black brothers and musicians, at the very least, thought we were interestingly quirky. We could talk. It was far more difficult to break through to white people. You always got the impression that you were definitely a threat, and all you'd done was ask, "Can I use your bathroom?" "You a boy or a girl? What you gonna do? Pull your cock out?" Back in England, we had a number one album, but out in the middle of America, nobody knew who we were. They were more aware of the Dave Clark Five and the swinging blue jeans. In some towns, we got some real hostility, real killer looks in our direction. Sometimes we got the sense that an exemplary lesson was about to be taught us, right then and there. We'd have to make a quick getaway in our faithful station wagon with Bob Bonis, our road manager. Great guy. He'd been on the road with Midgets, performing Monkees, with some of the best acts of all time. He eased us into America, driving 500 miles a day. A lot of our gigs in 64, 65 were piggybacked onto these other tours that were already lined up. So for 2 weeks, we'd be with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, the Vibrations, and a contortionist called the Amazing Rubber Man. And then we'd switch on to another circuit. First time I ever saw anybody lip-sync on stage was the Shangri-Las. Remember, walking in the sand. Three New York chicks, and they're very handsome and everything like that. But you suddenly realize there's no band. They're actually singing to a tape machine. And they were the Green Men, also Ohio, I think. They actually painted themselves green to perform their duty. Whatever was the flavor of the week or the month, some of them were damn good players. Especially in the Midwest and the Southwest. Those little bands playing any given night in bars, never gonna make it. And they didn't even want to. That's the beauty of it. And some of them damn good pickers. Wealth of talent out there. Guys that could play much better than I could. Sometimes we were top of the bill. Not always, but usually. And with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, there was young Sarah Dash, who had this woman chaperone dressed in her Sunday church outfit. If you smiled, you got a glare. They used to call her Inch. She was sweet. In short, 20 years later, she'll be back in my story. And of course, beginning in 65, I'm starting to get stoned. My lifelong habit now. Which also intensified my impression of what was going on. Just smoking the weed at the time. The guys I met on the road were to me then older men in their 30s, some in their 40s, black bands that we were playing with. We'd be up all night. We'd get the gig, and there would be these brothers in their sharkskin suits, the chain, the waistcoat, the hair gel, and they're all shaved and groomed, so fit and sweet, and we'd just drag our asses in. One day, I was feeling so ragged getting to the gig, and these brothers were so together, and shit, they were working the same schedule we were. So I said to one of these guys, a horn player, "Jesus, how do you look so good every day?" And he pulled his coat back, reached into his waistcoat pocket, and said, "You take one of these, you smoke one of those." best bit of advice. He gave me a little white pill, a white cross, and a joint. This is how we do it. You take one of these, and you smoke one of those. But keep it dark. That was the line I left the room with. Now we've told you, keep it dark. And I felt like I'd just been let into a secret society. Is it all right if I tell the other guys? Yeah, but keep it amongst yourselves. Backstage, it had been going on from time immemorial. The joint really got my attention. The joint got my attention so much that I forgot to take the Benzedrine. They made good speed in those days. Oh, yeah, it was pure. You could get hold of speed at any truck stop. Truck drivers relied upon it. Stop over here, pull over to some truck stop and ask for Dave. Give me a Jack Daniels on the rocks and a bag. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer. 2120 South Michigan Avenue was hallowed ground, the headquarters of Chess Records in Chicago. We got there in a last-minute arrangement made by Andrew Oldham, at a moment when the first half of our first U.S. tour seemed like a semi-disaster. There, in the perfect sound studio, in the room where everything we'd listened to was made, perhaps out of relief or just the fact that people like Buddy Guy, Chuck Berry, and Willie Dixon were wandering in and out, we recorded 14 tracks in 2 days. One of them was Bobby Womack's It's All Over Now, our first number one hit. Some people, Marshall Chess included, swear that I made this up. But Bill Wyman can back me up. We walked into Chess Studios, and there's this guy in black overalls painting the ceiling. And it's Muddy Waters. And he's got whitewash streaming down his face, and he's on top of a ladder. Marshall Chess says, we never had him painting. But Marshall was a boy then. He was working in the basement. And also Bill Wyman told me he actually remembers Muddy Waters taking our amplifiers from the car into the studio. Whether he was being a nice guy or he wasn't selling records then, I know what the Chess Brothers were bloody well like. If you want to stay on a payroll, get to work. Actually meeting your heroes, your idols. The weirdest thing is that most of them are so humble and very encouraging. Play that lick again, and you realize you're sitting with Muddy Waters. And of course, later I got to know him. Over many years, I frequently stayed at his house. In those early trips, I think it was Alan Wolfe's house I stayed at one night. But Muddy was there, sitting in the south side of Chicago with these two greats. And the family life, loads of kids and relatives walking in and out. Willie Dixon was there. In America, people like Bobby Womack used to say, first time we heard you guys, we thought you were black guys. Where'd these motherfuckers come from? I can't figure that out myself. Why Mick and I and that damn town should come up with such a sound. Except that if you soak it up in a damp tenement in London all day with the intensity that we did, it ain't that different from soaking it up in Chicago. That's all we played, until we actually became it. We didn't sound English, and I think that surprised us too. Each time we played, and I still do this at certain times, I just turn around and say, is that noise just coming from him, there, and me? It's almost as if you're riding a wild horse. In that respect, we're damn lucky we got to work with Charlie Watts. He was playing very much like black drummers, playing with Sam, Dave, and the Motown stuff, or the soul drummers. He has that touch. A lot of the time, very correct, with the sticks through the fingers, which is how most drummers now play. If you try to get savage, you're off. It's a bit like surfing. It's okay while you're up there. And because of that style of Charlie's, I could play the same way. One thing drives another in a band. It all has to melt together. Basically, it's all liquid. The most bizarre part of the whole story is that having done what we intended to do in our narrow, purest teenage brains at the time, which was to turn people onto the blues, what actually happened was we turned American people back on to their own music. And that's probably our greatest contribution to music. We turned white America's brain and ears around. I wouldn't say we were the only ones. Without the Beatles, probably nobody would have broken the door down. And they certainly weren't blues men. American black music was going along like an express train. But white cats, after Buddy Holly died and Eddie Cochran died, and Elvis was in the army gone wonky, white American music when I arrived was the Beach Boys and Bobby V. It was still stuck in the past. And the past was just 6 months ago. It wasn't a long time, but shit changed. The Beatles were the milestone, and then they got stuck inside their own cage, the Fab Four. Hence, eventually, you got the Monkees, all this ersatz shit. But I think there was a vacuum somewhere in white American music at the time. When we first got to America and to LA, there was a lot of Beach Boys on the radio, which is pretty funny to us. It was before Pet Sounds. It was hot rod songs and surfing songs, pretty lousily played, familiar Chuck Berry licks going on. Round, round, get round, I get round. I thought that was brilliant. It was later on listening to Pet Sounds. Well, it's all a little bit overproduced for me, but Brian Wilson had something. In My Room, Don't Worry, Baby. I was more interested in their B-sides, the ones he slipped in. There was no particular correlation with what we were doing, so I could just listen to it on another level. I thought, these are very well-constructed songs. I took easily to the pop song idiom. I'd always listened to everything, and America opened it all out. We were hearing records there that were regional hits. We'd get in our local labels and local acts, which is how we came across Time Is On My Side in L.A., sung by Irma Thomas. It was a B-side of a record on Imperial Records, a label we'd been made aware of because it was independent and successful and based on Sunset Strip. I've talked to guys since, like Joe Walsh of the Eagles and many other white musicians, about what they listened to when they were growing up. And it was all very provincial and narrow and depended on the local, usually white, FM radio station. Bobby Keys, he reckons he can tell where someone come from by their musical taste. Joe Walsh heard us play when he was at high school, and he's told me that it had a huge effect on him simply because nobody he knew had ever heard anything like that. Because there wasn't anything. He was listening to doo-wop, and that was about it. He had never heard Muddy Waters. Amazingly, he was first exposed to the blues, he said, by hearing us. He also decided there and then that the minstrel's life was for him. And now you can't go into any diner without hearing him weaving that guitar of his on Hotel California. Jim Dickinson, the Southern boy, who played piano on Wild Horses, was exposed to black music through the powerful and only black radio station, WDIA, when he was growing up in Memphis. So when he went to college in Texas, he had a musical education that exceeded that of anybody he met there. But he never saw any black musicians, even though he lived in Memphis, except once he saw the Memphis Jug Band with Will Shade and Good Kid on the washboard when they was playing in the street when he was 9. But the racial barriers were so severe that those kind of players were inaccessible to him. Then Furry Lewis, whose funeral he played, and Booker White and others were being brought out to play via the folk revival. I do think maybe the Stones had a lot to do with making people twiddle their knobs a little more. When we put out Little Red Rooster, a raw Willie Dixon blues with sly guitar and all, was a daring move at the time, November 1964. We were getting no-nos from the record company, management, and everyone else. But we felt we were on the crest of a wave and we could push it. It was almost in defiance of pop. In our arrogance at the time, we wanted to make a statement. I am the Little Red Rooster, too lazy to crow for day. See if you can get that to the top of the charts, motherfucker. Son of a chicken. Mick and I stood up and said, come on, let's push it. This is what we're fucking about. And the floodgates burst after that. Suddenly, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf and Buddy Guy are getting gigs and working. It was a breakthrough, and the record got a number one. And I am absolutely sure what we were doing made Berry Gordy at Motown capable of pushing his stuff elsewhere. And it certainly rejuvenated Chicago blues as well. I keep a notebook where I write down sketches and song ideas, and it contains this. Juke joint. Alabama? Georgia? Finally, I'm in my element. An incredible band is wailing on a stage, decorated with phosphorescent paint. The dance floor is moving as one. So does the sweat and the ribs cooking out back. The only thing that makes me stand out is that I'm white. Wonderfully, no one notices this aberration. I am accepted. I'm made to feel so warm. I am in heaven. Most towns, like White Nashville, for example, by 10 o'clock were ghost towns. We were working with black guys, the Vibrations, Don Bradley, I think his name was. The most amazing act, they could do everything. They were doing somersaults while they were playing. What are you going to do after the show? This is already an invitation. So I get in the cab and we go across the tracks and it's just starting to happen. There's food going, everybody's rocking and rolling. Everybody's having a good time. And it was such a contrast from the white side of town. Always sticks in my memory. You could hang there with ribs, drinks, smoke, and big mamas. For some reason, they always looked upon us as thin and frail people. So they started to mama us, which was all right with me. Shoved into the middle of two enormous breasts. You need a rub down, boy? Okay, anything you say, mama. Just the free and easiness of it. You wake up in a house full of black people who have been so incredibly kind to you, you can't believe it. I mean, shit, I wish this happened at home. And this happened in every town. You wake up, where am I? And there's a big mama there, and you're in bed with her daughter, but you get breakfast in bed. The first time I stared into a gun barrel was in the men's room of the Civic Auditorium, I believe, in Omaha, Nebraska. It was in the fist of a big grizzled cop. I was with Brian backstage at soundcheck. We used to drink scotch and coke at the time. Anyway, we took our paper cups with us and answered the call of nature, cup in hand. Happily, we splashed away. I heard the door open behind us. Okay, turn around slowly, a voice wheezed. Fuck off, Brian said. I mean now, came the wheeze. Shaking off the drips, we looked around. A massive cop with a huge revolver in his huge fist fix us with a menacing regard. Silence ruled as Brian and I stared at the black hole. This is a public building. No alcoholic beverages allowed. You will tip the contents of your cups into the john. Now, no quick moves. do it. Brian and I cracked up, but did as we were told. He did have the upper hand. Brian said something about heavy-handed overreaction, which only infuriated the old bugger, to the point that the barrel began to tremble. So we blabbered about being unaware of the city ordinance, to which he barked out something about ignorance not being a defense in the eyes of the law. I was about to ask how he knew we were drinking booze, but I thought better of it. We had another bottle in the dressing room. It was soon after that that I picked up a Smith & Wesson 38 special. It was the Wild West. Still is. I picked it up at a truck stop for $25, plus ammo. Thus began my illicit relationship with that venerable firm. I'm not on their books. Quite a few of the guys we were travelling with were carrying shooters. They were fucking hard cats who I worked with. I remember that other side of it. Pools of blood oozing out of dressing rooms and realizing there's a beating going on and you don't want to get involved. But the biggest horror of all was seeing the cops turn up, especially backstage. You should have seen some of the band run, baby. A lot of cats on the road were on the run for one reason or another, probably minor offences like not paying their alimony or auto theft. You were not working with saints here. They were good players and they could pick up a gig and disappear amongst the minstrels. They were streetwise like motherfucker. Backstage, a squad of cops would arrive with a warrant for somebody who was playing guitar in some band. It was kind of like the press gang had arrived. Oh my God, the panic. You'd see Ike Turner's piano player zooming down the stairs. By the end of that first American tour, we thought we'd blown it in America. We'd been consigned to the status of medicine shows and circus freaks with long hair. When we got to Carnegie Hall in New York, we were suddenly back in England with screaming teeny boppers. America was coming around. We realized that it was just starting. Mick and I hadn't come all the way to New York in 1964 not to go to the Apollo, so I hooked up again with Ronnie Bennett. We went to Jones Beach with all the Ronettes in a red Cadillac. The desk rang up. There's a lady downstairs. Come on, let's go. And it was James Brown's week at the Apollo. Maybe Ronnie should describe what nice English boys we were, contrary to popular belief. The first time Keith and Mick came to America, they weren't successful. They slept in my mother's living room floor up in Spanish Harlem. They had no money, and my mom would get up in the morning and make them bacon and eggs. And Keith would always say, "Thank you, Mrs. Bennett." And then I took them to see James Brown at the Apollo. And that's what made them so determined. Those guys went home and they came back superstars. Because I showed them what I did, how I grew up, and how I went to the Apollo Theater when I was 11 years old. I took them backstage and they met all these rhythm and blues stars. I remember Mick standing there shaking when we passed James Brown's room. The first time I went to heaven was when I awoke with Ronnie, later Spectre, Bennett, asleep with a smile on her face. We were kids. It doesn't get any better than that. Just more refined. What can I say? She took me to her parents' house, took me to her bedroom, several times. But that was the first time. And I'm just a guitar player, you know what I mean? James Brown had the whole week there at the Apollo. Go to the Apollo and see James Brown, damn fucking right. I mean, who would turn that down? He was a piece of work. So on the button. We thought we were a tight band. The discipline in the band impressed me more than anything else. On stage, James would snap his fingers if he thought somebody had missed a beat or hit a wrong note. and you could see the player's face fall. He would signal the find, he'd impose with his fingers. These guys would be watching his hands. I even saw Maceo Parker, a sax player who was the architect of James Brown's band, who I finally got to work with in the Winos. Get fined about $50 that night. It was a fantastic show. Mick looking at his foot moves. Mick took more notice than I did that day. Lead singer, dancing, he calls the shots. Backstage that night, James wanted to show off to these English folk. He's got the famous flames and he's sending one out for an hamburger. He's ordering another to polish his shoes and he's humiliating his own band. To me, it was the famous flames and James Brown happened to be the lead singer. But the way he lorded it over his minions, his minders and the actual band, to Mick was fascinating. When we got back to England, the big difference was seeing old friends, mostly musicians, who were already amazed that we were the Rolling Stones, but now, you've been to the States, man. You were suddenly aware that you'd been distanced just by the fact that you'd been to America. It actually really pissed off the English fans. It happened with the Beatles fans, too. You were no longer there. There was a sense of resentment, never more so than in Blackpool. There, at the Empress Ballroom, a few days after our return, we faced the mob again, though this time a rabble army of Scotch drunks baying for blood. They used to have what they called Scotch Week. All the factories in Glasgow shut down, and nearly everybody from there went to Blackpool, the seaside resort. We start the gig, and it's jam-packed. A lot of guys, a lot of them very, very pissed, all dressed up in their Sunday best. And suddenly, while I'm playing, this little red-headed fucker flobs on me. So I move aside, and he follows me and flobs on me again, hits me in the face. So I stand in front of him again, and he spits at me again, and with the stage, his head was just about near my shoe, like a penalty shot in football. I just went bang and knocked his fucking head off with the grace of Beckham. He's never walked the same since. And after that, the riot broke out. They smashed everything, including the piano. We didn't see a piece of equipment that came back any bigger than 3 inches square with wires hanging out. We got out of there by the skin of our teeth. In the days after our return from the US, we appeared on Jukebox Jury, a long-established format presided over by a TV pro called David Jacobs, in which the celebs on the jury discussed the records Jacobs played and then voted them hits or misses. This is one of those landmark moments that completely escaped us while it was happening. But in the media later, it was seen as a declaration of generational war, the cause of outrage, fear and loathing. On the same day, we taped a show called Top of the Pops to promote our Bobby Womack single, It's All Over Now. I'd gotten used to lip-syncing without blushing. That's the way it was done. Very few shows were live. We were getting a little bit cynical about the tripe market. You realised you're really in one of the sleaziest businesses there is, without actually being a gangster. It was a business where the only time people laughed was when they screwed someone else over. I have a feeling that by then we kind of realised the role that we were being cast in, and that there was no fight in it. And anyway, nobody had really played it before, and this would be kind of fun. And we didn't give a shit. Andrew Oldham describes our Jukebox Jury appearance in his book Stoned. With no prompting from me, they proceeded to behave as complete and utter yobbos. and in 25 minutes managed to confirm the nation's worst opinion of them for once and all. They grunted, they laughed among themselves, were merciless towards the drivel that was played, and hostile towards the unflappable Mr. Jacobs. This was no planned press move. Brian and Bill made some effort to be polite, but Mick and Keith and Charlie would have none of it. Nobody was particularly witty or anything. We just trashed every record they played. While the record was playing, we were going, "I'm not fit to comment on this. You can't listen to this stuff, be serious." And there's David Jacobs trying to cover up the dirt. Jacobs was smarmy, but he was actually quite a nice guy. I mean, it had been so easy up till then. Helen Shapiro and Al McCogan, reliable variety club sorts of people. All those showbiz comfy societies that everybody was roped into. And then we come out of nowhere. I've no doubt that David was thinking, "Thanks a lot, BBC. I want a raise after working with this lot." It won't get any better. Wait for the Sex Pistols, mate. The Variety Club was like the inner circle at the time in showbiz. You didn't know if it was Freemasons or a charity. It was a clique that basically ran show business. Weirdly archaic English showbiz mafia. We were thrown into all this in order to tear it apart. They were still playing their game, Billy Cotton, Al McCogan. But you realise that all these celebs, and really very few of them were talented, had an incredible swing on things. Who got to play where, who could close doors on you, and who would open them. And luckily, the Beatles had already shown them all what was what. I mean, the writing was on the wall already. So when they had to deal with us, they didn't know quite which way to pussyfoot. The only reason we got a record deal with Decca was because Dick Rowe turned down the Beatles. EMI got them, and he could not afford to make the same mistake twice. Decca was desperate. I'm amazed the guy still had the job. I mean, at the time, just like anything else in popular entertainment, they thought, "It's just a fad, it's just a matter of a few haircuts, and we'll tame them anyway." Basically, we only got a record deal because they could not afford to fuck up twice. Otherwise, they wouldn't have touched us with a barge pole. Just out of prejudice. I mean, that whole structure was Variety Club. A nod and a wink here and there. Suppose it served its purpose at the time, no doubt, but suddenly they realised, bang, welcome to the 20th century, and it's 1964 already. Things happened incredibly fast from the moment Andrew turned up, to me at least. There was a certain feeling that things were running away from us, but you also realise you've just been noosed, honey, and you're going to have to go with it. I was a little bit hesitant to run with it to start with, but Andrew knows it didn't take me long. We were of a very similar mind. Let's figure out how to use Fleet Street. This is partly provoked by an incident at a photo session we did, when one of the photographers said to Andrew, "They're so dirty." Andrew's flashpoint was low, and he decided then that from now on, he'd give them what they described. He suddenly saw the beauty of opposites. He'd already done the Beatles stuff with Epstein, so he was a street ahead of me. But he did find a willing partner in me, I must say. Even at that age, there was a chemistry between us. Later, we became firmer friends, but at the time, I looked at him just as Andrew looked at us. I can use these bastards. The media was so easy to manipulate, we could do anything we wanted. We'd get thrown out of hotels, piss on a garage forecourt. Actually, that was a total accident. Once Bill wants to take a pee, it doesn't stop for about half an hour. Jesus Christ, where does little bloke put all that? We went to the Grand Hotel in Bristol deliberately to get thrown out. Andrew called Fleet Street to say, "If you want to watch the Stones get thrown out of the Grand Hotel, be there at such and such a time," because we were dressed incorrectly. The way Andrew could set them up, we'd have them panting for nothing. And of course it provoked things like, "Would you let your daughter marry one?" Well, I don't know whether Andrew planted that idea on somebody or whether it was just one of those lunchtime oboes ideas. We were obnoxious, but these people were so complacent, they didn't know what hit them. It was blitzkrieg, really, an assault on the whole PR setup, and suddenly you realize there's this landscape out there, these people that need to be told what to do. While we were pulling all these stunts, Andrew was going round in a Chevrolet Impala driven by Reg, his butch gay chauffeur from Stepney. Reg was a very nasty piece of work. In those days, it was a miracle to get four lines from a rock journalist at New Musical Express. But it was important because there was very little radio, not much TV. There was a writer at the Record Mirror called Richard Green who had used that precious space to write about my complexion. I didn't even suffer from the blemishes he described, but this was the last straw for Andrew. He took Reg and he barged into the writer's office. And with Reg holding his hands under the open window, he said to Richard, I quote again from Andrew's memoir, "Richard, I got a call this morning from a very hurt and upset Mrs. Richards. Now, you don't know her, but she's Keith Richards' mum. She said, 'Mr. Oldham, can you do anything to stop what this man keeps saying about my boy's acne? I know you can't stop that rubbish about how they don't wash, but Keith is a sensitive boy, even if he doesn't say so. Please, Mr. Oldham, can you do anything?' So, Richard, this is the story. If you ever again write something about Keith that is out of line, that is hurtful to his mum, because I'm responsible to Keith's mum, your hands will be where they are now, but with one big difference. Reg here will bring that fucking window crashing down on your ugly hands, and you will not be writing, you malicious fat turd, for a long fucking time, and you won't be dictating either, because your jaw will be sewn up from where Reg fucking broke it." And with that, as it goes, they made their excuses and left. I didn't even realize until I read his book that Andrew was still living with his mother while he was pulling off all this daring do. Maybe that had something to do with it. He was smarter and sharper than the arseholes that were running the media, or the people running the record companies, who were totally out of touch with what was happening. You could just run in and rob the whole bank. It was a bit Clockwork Orange. There was no great universal, "We want to change society." We just knew that things were changing and that they could be changed. They were just too comfortable. It was all too satisfied. And we thought, how can we run rampant? Of course, all of us ran into the brick wall of the establishment. It was an impetus that couldn't be stopped. It was like when somebody says something and you've got the most fantastic reply, you know you really shouldn't say it, but it has to be said. Even though you know it's going to get you in shit, it's too good a line not to say. You'd feel that you chickened out on yourself if you didn't say it. Oldham modelled himself, to an extent, on his idol Phil Spector, as a producer as well as a manager. But unlike Spector, he wasn't a natural in the studio. I doubt whether Andrew would call me a liar when I say he was not very musical. He knew what he liked and what other people liked. But if you said E7th to him, you might as well be saying, "What's the meaning of life?" To me, a producer is somebody that at the end of the day comes out with everybody going, "Yeah, we got it." Andrew's musical input was minimal. and it was usually saved for backup vocals. La 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 here. Okay, we'll throw someone. He'd never gotten away with the way we did things, whether he agreed with it or not. But as a fully-fledged producer with knowledge of recording and knowledge of music, he was on weaker ground. He had good taste for the market, especially once we went to America. The minute we got to America, it took the scales from his eyes as to what we were about, and more he let us just get on with it. And basically, that was the genius, I think, of Andrew's method of producing, to let us make the records, and to provide a lot of energy and enthusiasm. When you've got to take 30 and you're starting to flag a bit, you need that encouragement thing. Just one more take. Come on. Unflagging enthusiasm. We've got it. We're nearly there. When I was growing up, the idea of leaving England was pretty much remote. My dad did it once, but that was in the army to go to Normandy and get his leg blown off. The idea was totally impossible. You just read about other countries and looked at them on TV and in National Geographic. The black chicks with their tits hanging out and their long necks. But you never expected to see it. Scraping up the money to get out of England would have been way beyond my capabilities. One of the first places I remember us going to, after the USA, was Belgium. And even that was an adventure. It was like going to Tibet. And the Olympia and Paris. And then suddenly you're in Australia and you're actually seeing the world. And they're paying you. But my God, there are some black holes. Dunedin, for instance. Almost the southernmost city in the world in New Zealand. It looked like Tombstone and it felt like it. It still had hitching rails. It was Sunday, a wet, dark Sunday in Dunedin in 1965. I don't think you could have found anything more depressing anywhere. The longest day of my life. It seemed to go on forever. We were usually pretty good at entertaining ourselves, but Dunedin made Aberdeen seem like Las Vegas. Very rarely did everybody get depressed at the same time. There's usually one to support the others. But in Dunedin, everybody was totally depressed. No chance of any redemption or laughter. Even the drink didn't get you pissed. On Sunday, there'd be little knocks on the door. Church in 10 minutes. It was just one of those miserable grey days that took me back to my childhood, I suppose. A day that will never end. A gloom. And not anything on the horizon. Boredom is an illness to me, and I don't suffer from it. But that moment was the lowest ebb. I think I'll stand on my head, try and recycle the drugs. But Roy Orbison. It was only because we were with Roy Orbison that we were there at all. He was definitely top of the bill that night. What a beacon in the southernmost gloom. The amazing Roy Orbison. He was one of those Texan guys who could sail through anything, including his whole tragic life. His kids die in a fire. His wife dies in a car crash. Nothing in his private life went right for the big O. But I cannot think of a gentler gentleman or a more stoic personality. That incredible talent for blowing himself up from 5'6" to 6'9".